Well, hello, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast again. I'm Cory Doctorow, and I'll be continuing to read Bruce Sterling's wonderful book, The Hacker Crackdown, to you this week. This is a special podcast in that it's the 100th one of these that I've recorded. There's actually been more than 100 installments in the podcast because, of course, I fold in audio, other audio that I do with other people. But yeah, this is the 100th one of these that I've sat down and recorded. Since Mark Pesce convinced me that it'd be a good idea to actually do a podcast, and I'm amazed I've made it this far. Who knew? Anyway, the renovations continue apace here. The bookcases are going back up again on Monday, and all the books will come up off my floor, and everything will be tidied up, and then the guys are coming around to bring stuff into the storage locker on Tuesday, and then Wednesday the cleaner comes and cleans up, and Thursday my parents arrive for a week. So it's just slightly crazy. Lots of people have written to me and said, hey, you're back in London, let's get together and socialize. And much as I'd like to do that, there's just no chance of anything like a social life for quite some time, unfortunately. Interesting stuff this week. Well, there's been a solicitation for me to do a collection of essays in book form, which I'm pretty excited about. I'm thinking of calling it Coded Messages. I don't know. That's just the title I came up with at dinner last night. My agent hasn't yet sorted out the details or whether we're going to do it, but it's kind of a cool idea to collect the essays together in one place. The only other news, I guess, is that I continue to look for an office in central London. If you know anyone who's got a spare room in their office with a door on it that closes and locks, or, well, at least that closes, that I can use for a writing office somewhere in central London who wants to rent it out, I'd be delighted to sublet someone's office from them. Well, without any more ado, let's get back down to Bruce Sterling's amazing book, The Hacker Crackdown, Law and Order on the Electronic Frontier. Is that what the subtitle is? Something like that. Reading to you from the section entitled Law and Order. And this aspect of Sun Devil was carried out with great success. Sun Devil seems to have been a complete tactical surprise. Unlike the fragmentary and continuing seizures of the war on the Legion of Doom, Sun Devil was precisely timed and utterly overwhelming. At least 40 computers were seized during May 7th, 8th, and 9th, 1980, in Cincinnati, Detroit, Los Angeles, Miami, Newark, Phoenix, Tucson, Richmond, San Diego, San Jose, Pittsburgh, and San Francisco. Some cities saw multiple raids, such as the 5 separate raids in the New York City environs. Plano, Texas, essentially a suburb of the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex and a hub of the telecommunications industry, saw 4 computer seizures. Chicago, ever in the forefront, saw its own local Sun Devil raid, briskly carried out by Secret Service agents Timothy Foley and Barbara Golden. Many of these raids occurred not in the cities proper, but in associated white middle-class suburbs, places like Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania, and Clark Lake, Michigan. There were a few raids on offices. Most took place in people's homes, the classic hacker basements and bedrooms. The Sun Devil raids were searches and seizures, not a group of mass arrests. There were only 4 arrests during Sun Devil. Tony the Trash Man, a longtime teenage bete noir of the Arizona Racketeering Unit, was arrested in Tucson on May 9th. Dr. Ripko, sysop of an outlaw board with the misfortune to exist in Chicago itself, was also arrested on illegal weapons charges. Local units also arrested a 19-year-old female phone freak named Electra in Pennsylvania, and a male juvenile in California. Federal agents, however, were not seeking arrests, but computers. Hackers are generally not indicted, if at all, until the evidence in their seized computers is evaluated, a process that can take weeks, months, even years. When hackers are arrested on the spot, it's generally an arrest for other reasons. Drugs and/or illegal weapons show up in a good third of anti-hacker computer seizures, though not during Sun Devil. That scofflaw teenage hackers, or their parents, should have marijuana in their homes is probably not a shocking revelation. But the surprisingly common presence of illegal firearms in hacker dens is a bit disquieting. A personal computer can be a great equalizer for the techno cowboy, much like the more traditional American great equalizer, the personal six-gun. Maybe it's not all that surprising that some guy obsessed with power through illicit technology would also have a few illicit high-velocity impact devices around. An element of the digital underground particularly dotes on these anarchy files, and this element tends to shade into the crackpot milieu of survivalists, gun nuts, anarcho-leftists, and the ultra-libertarian right wing. This is not to say that hacker raids to date have uncovered any major crackdens or illegal arsenals, but Secret Service agents do not regard hackers as just kids. They regard hackers as unpredictable people, bright and slippery. It doesn't help matters that the hacker himself has been hiding behind his keyboard all this time. Commonly, police have no idea what he looks like. This makes him an unknown quantity, someone best treated with proper caution. To date, no hacker has come out shooting, though they sometimes brag on boards that they will do just that. Threats of this sort are taken seriously. Secret Service hacker raids tend to be swift, comprehensive, well-manned, even overmanned, and JIT agents generally burst through every door in the home at once, sometimes with drawn guns. Any potential resistance is swiftly quelled. Hacker raids are usually raids on people's homes. It can be a very dangerous business to raid an American home. People can panic when strangers invade their sanctum. Statistically speaking, the most dangerous thing a policeman can do is enter someone's home. The second most dangerous thing to do is to stop a car in traffic. People have guns in their homes. More cops are hurt in homes than are ever hurt in biker bars or massage parlors. But in any case, no one was hurt during Sundevil, or indeed during any part of the hacker crackdown. Nor were there any allegations of any physical mistreatment of a suspect. Guns were pointed, interrogations were sharp and prolonged, but no one in 1990 claimed any act of brutality by any crackdown raider. In addition to the 40 or so computers, Sundevil reaped floppy disks in particularly great abundance, an estimated 23,000 of them, which naturally included every matter of illegitimate data, pirated games, stolen codes, hot credit card numbers, the complete text and software of entire pirate bulletin boards. These floppy disks, which remain in police custody today, offer a gigantic, almost embarrassingly rich source of potential criminal indictments. These 23,000 floppy disks also include a thus far unknown quantity of legitimate computer games, legitimate software, purportedly private mail from boards, business records, and personal correspondence of all kinds. Standard computer crime search warrants lay great emphasis on seizing written documents as well as computers, specifically including photocopies, computer printouts, telephone bills, address books, logs, notes, memoranda, and correspondence. In practice, this has meant that diaries, gaming magazines, software documentation, nonfiction books on hacking and computer security, sometimes even science fiction novels, have all vanished out the door in police custody. A wide variety of electronic items have been known to vanish as well, including telephones, televisions, answering machines, Sony Walkmans, desktop printers, compact discs, and audio tapes. No fewer than 150 members of the Secret Service were sent into the field during Sundevil. They were commonly accompanied by squads of local and/or state police. Many of these officers, especially the locals, had never been on an anti-hacker raid before. This was one good reason, in fact, why so many of them were invited along in the first place. Also, the presence of a uniformed police officer assures the raidees that the people entering their homes are, in fact, police. Secret Service agents wear plain clothes, so do telco security experts who accompanied the Secret Service on raids, and who make no particular effort to identify themselves as mere employees of the telephone companies. A typical hacker raid goes something like this. First, police storm in rapidly, through every entrance, with overwhelming force, in the assumption that this tactic will keep casualties to a minimum. Second, possible suspects are immediately removed from the vicinity of any and all computer systems, so they will have no chance to purge or destroy computer evidence. Suspects are herded into a room without computers, commonly the living room, and kept under guard, not armed guard, for the guns are swiftly holstered, but under guard nevertheless. They are presented with the search warrant, and warned that anything they say may be held against them. Commonly, they have a great deal to say, especially if they're unsuspecting parents. Somewhere in the house is the hot spot, a computer tied to a phone line, possibly several computers and several phones. Commonly, it's a teenager's bedroom, but it can be anywhere in the house. There may be several such rooms. The hot spot is put in the charge of a two-agent team, the finder and the recorder. The finder is computer-trained, commonly the case agent who actually obtained the search warrant from a judge. He or she understands what is being sought, and actually carries out the seizures, unplugs machines, opens drawers, desks, files, floppy disk containers, etc. The recorder photographs all the equipment just as it stands, especially the tangle of wired connections in the back, which can otherwise be a real nightmare to restore. The recorder will also commonly photograph every room in the house, lest some wily criminal claim that the police robbed him during the search. Some recorders carry video cams or tape recorders. However, it's more common for the recorder to simply take written notes. Objects are described and numbered as the finder seizes them, generally on standard pre-printed police inventory forms. Even Secret Service agents were not and are not expert computer users. They have not made and do not make judgments on the fly about potential threats posed by various forms of equipment. They may exercise discretion. They may leave Dad his computer, for example, but they don't have to. Standard computer crime search warrants, which date back to the early 80s, use a sweeping language that targets computers, most anything attached to a computer, most anything used to operate a computer, most anything that remotely resembles a computer, plus most any and all written documents surrounding it. Computer crime investigators have strongly urged agents to seize the works. In this case, Operation Sun Devil appears to have been a complete success. Boards went down all over America and were shipped en masse to the Computer Investigation Lab of the Secret Service in Washington, D.C., along with 23,000 floppy disks and unknown quantities of printed material. But the seizure of 25 boards and the multi-megabyte mountains of possibly useful evidence contained in these boards and in their owners' other computers, also out the door, were far from the only motives for Operation Sun Devil. An unprecedented action of great ambition and size, Sun Devil's motives can only be described as political. It was a public relations effort, meant to pass certain messages, meant to make certain situations clear, both in the mind of the general public and in the mind of various constituencies of the electronic community. First, and this motivation was vital, a message would be sent from law enforcement to the digital underground. This very message was recited in so many words by Gary M. Jenkins, the assistant director of the U.S. Secret Service, at the Sun Devil press conference in Phoenix on May 9, 1990, immediately after the raids. In brief, hackers were mistaken in their foolish belief that they could hide behind the relative anonymity of their computer terminals. On the contrary, they should fully understand that the state and federal cops were actively patrolling their beat in cyberspace, that they were on the watch everywhere, even in those sleazy and secretive dens of cybernetic vice, the underground boards. This is not an unusual message for police to publicly convey to crooks. The message is a standard message. Only the context is new. In this respect, the Sun Devil raids were the digital equivalent of the standard Vice Squad crackdown on massage parlors, porno bookstores, head shops, or floating crap games. There may be few or no arrests in the raid of this sort. No convictions, no trials, no interrogations. In cases of the sort, police may well walk out the door with many pounds of sleazy magazines, X-rated videotapes, sex toys, gambling equipment, baggies of marijuana. Of course, if something truly horrendous is discovered by the raiders, there will be arrests and prosecutions. Far more likely, however, there will simply be a brief but sharp disruption of the closed and secretive world of no goodnicks. There will be street hassle, heat, deterrence, and, of course, the immediate loss of the seized goods. It is very unlikely that any of this seized material will ever be returned. Whether charged or not, whether convicted or not, the perpetrators will almost surely lack the nerve to ever ask for this stuff to be given back. Arrests and trials, putting people in jail, may involve all kinds of formal legalities, but dealing with the justice system is far from the only task of police. Police do not simply arrest people. They don't simply put people in jail. This is not how the police perceive their jobs. Police protect and serve. Police keep the peace. They keep public order. Like other forms of public relations, keeping public order is not an exact science. Keeping public order is something of an art form. If a group of tough-looking teenage hoodlums was loitering on a street corner, no one would be surprised to see a street cop arrive and sternly order them to break it up. On the contrary, the surprise would come if one of these ne'er-do-wells stepped briskly into a phone booth, called a civil rights lawyer, and instituted a civil suit in defense of his constitutional rights of free speech and free assembly. But something much along this line was one of the many anomalous outcomes of the hacker crackdown. Sun Devil also carried useful messages for other constituents of the electronic community. These messages may not have been read aloud from the Phoenix podium in front of the press corps, but there was little mistaking their meaning. There was the message of reassurance for the primary victims of coding and carding, the telcos and the credit companies. Sun Devil was greeted with joy by the security officers of the electronic business community. After years of high-tech harassment and spiraling revenue losses, their complaints of rampant outlawry were being taken seriously by law enforcement. No more head-scratching or dismissive shrugs, no more feeble excuses about the lack of computer-trained officers or the low priority of victimless, white-collar telecommunications crimes. Computer crime experts have long believed that computer-related offenses are drastically underreported. They regard this as a major open scandal of the field. Some victims are reluctant to come forth because they believe that police and prosecutors are not computer literate and can and will do nothing. Others are embarrassed by their vulnerabilities and will take strong measures to avoid any publicity. This is especially true of banks, who fear a loss of investor confidence should an embezzlement case or wire fraud ever surface. And some victims are so helplessly confused by their own high technology that they never even realize that a crime has occurred, even when they have been fleeced to the bone. The result of this situation can be dire. Criminals escape apprehension and punishment. The computer crime units that do exist can't get work. The true scope of computer crime, its size, its real nature, the scope of its threats, and the legal remedies for it all remain obscured. Another problem is very little publicized, but it is a cause of genuine concern. Where there is persistent crime but no effective police protection, then vigilantism can result. Telcos, banks, credit companies, the major corporations who maintain extensive computer networks vulnerable to hacking, these organizations are powerful, wealthy, and politically influential. They are disinclined to be pushed around by crooks, or by most anyone else for that matter. They often maintain well-organized private security forces, commonly run by experienced veterans of military and police units who have left public service for greener pastures of the private sector. For police, the corporate security manager can be a powerful ally, but if this gentleman finds no allies in the police, and the pressure is on from his board of directors, he may quietly take certain matters into his own hands. Nor is there any lack of disposable hired help in the corporate security business. Private security agencies, the security business generally, grew explosively in the 1980s. Today, there are spooky gumshoot armies of security consultants, rent-a-cops, private eyes, outside experts, every manner of shady operator who retails in results and discretion. Of course, many of these gentlemen and ladies may be paragons of professional and moral rectitude, but as anyone who has read a hard-boiled detective novel knows, police tend to be less than fond of this sort of private sector competition. Companies in search of computer security have even been known to hire hackers. Police shudder at this prospect. Police treasure good relations with the business community. Rarely will you see a policeman so indiscreet as to allege publicly that some major employer in his state or city has succumbed to paranoia and gone off the rails. Nevertheless, police, and computer police in particular, are aware of this possibility. Computer crime police can and do spend up to half their business hours just doing public relations, seminars, dog and pony shows, sometimes with parents groups or computer users, but generally with their core audience, the likely victims of hacking crimes. These, of course, are telcos, credit card companies, and large computer-equipped corporations. The police strongly urge these people, as good citizens, to report offenses and press criminal charges. They pass the message that there is someone in authority who cares, understands, and best of all, will take useful action should a computer crime occur. But reassuring talk is cheap. Sundevil offered action. The final message of Sundevil was intended for internal consumption by law enforcement. Sundevil was offered as proof that the community of American computer crime police had come of age. Sundevil was proof that enormous things like Sundevil itself could now be accomplished. Sundevil was proof that the Secret Service and its local law enforcement allies could act like a well-oiled machine, despite the hampering use of those scrambled phones. It was also proof that the Arizona Organized Crime and Racketeering Unit, the spark plug of Sundevil, ranked with the best in the world in ambition, organization, and sheer conceptual daring. And, as a final fillip, Sundevil was a message from the Secret Service to their longtime rivals in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. By congressional fiat, both USSS and FBI formally shared jurisdiction over federal computer crime-busting activities. Neither of these groups has ever been remotely happy with this muddled situation. It seems to suggest that Congress cannot make up its mind as to which of these groups is better qualified, and there is scarcely a G-man or a special agent anywhere without a very firm opinion on that topic.